So I want to talk a little bit about the Four Noble Truths, or at least a few of them. There's always tomorrow. To go on to freedom and the path, although I think we'll get maybe through the third today. I'll try anyway. The first noble truth usually being talked about as the assertion of the Buddha is that there is suffering in life. The word suffering is a very common, although a little bit old-fashioned at this point, translation of the word from Pali, dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A. When I was first practicing, I heard it translated as suffering, and so it remains very much that in my own mind. Sometimes it's translated as insecurity, distress, unsatisfactoriness, anguish. I've heard, sort of nouveau translation is stress. But having a somewhat classical background in Buddhist teaching, I hear stress and it's like a little much for me to make the transition to. Although it's not wrong. Because the word dukkha means many things and has lots of layers and lots of textures, and it's a very complex notion. The idea that there is suffering or dukkha in life doesn't mean it's all bad and bleak and miserable. It's not that at all. But it's more like a very, as Bob Thurman would say, realistic view of experience. And from my perspective, the more truthful our vision is of how things are, the better off we are. That seeing the truth cannot be wrong. It cannot be harmful. Even though it can be difficult to bear. That's another actual classical translation of dukkha, is difficult to bear. If it's true, then it's important to see it, with that perspective, that vision. And it will only enhance our lives. It can only uplift us in the end. So dukkha is very complex. It's very intricate. In many schools of Buddhism, of the Buddhist teaching, they'll talk about three kinds of dukkha, or you could say three kinds of suffering, if you use that translation. The first is rather charmingly translated as dukkha-dukkha. And I think maybe even the Dalai Lama talked about that here, when he was here in April. It's called dukkha-dukkha. It's the suffering of suffering. And this is commonly acknowledged unpleasantness, suffering, that which is difficult to bear. We have a headache. We get a disease. We're parted from a loved one. We lose our job. We lose our home. There's a devastating incident. It's painful. We can all acknowledge that is a difficult thing to go through. And there's much of life, as we were talking this morning, where that is a part of everybody's experience and yet can be unacknowledged, cut off, put aside, discarded, denied, lied about. There are many ways in which we can have a very unfortunate or unhealthy relationship to acknowledging this truth. And yet, realizing it can be very liberating. I'd say that for myself, when I was in college and first heard about the Buddha's teaching, which was in an Asian philosophy course that I did as a sophomore. It really turned out to be a course in Buddhism. This was an essential part of what sent me to India within like 6 months, was the Buddha's very unashamed, unafraid acknowledgement of the suffering in life. Because like for many people, I was 18 when I left for India, so I was 17 at the time I did the course. you know, like many people, I'd had a great deal of suffering in my life, in my childhood. And like for many people, it was all within a family system where this is never, ever spoken about. So I didn't know what to do with all of those feelings inside of me. And yet here was the Buddha saying right out loud what I'd never heard anybody say out loud. It's painful. Life can really hurt. Things can go very wrong. And that was such an enormous relief for me that it was a tremendous inspiration. And then, of course, there was a second part of his statement, which was we can do something about at least the internal suffering that we feel. You know, the add-ons, the exacerbation, the shame, the loneliness, the bitterness. We can do something about that, and everybody can do something about that. No one left out of that sense of possibility. And there's some very practical tools. So those two things put together sent me off to India. And it seems like it's very important to be able to acknowledge, yeah, it really hurts. I mean, look how much in our society we employ a euphemism for, you know, the golden years, nursing home, or whatever it is, or, you know, if we even know that it exists. It's really quite startling. And the levels within levels and within levels of that which is hidden, you know, that which is put apart. But what would happen if we actually were able to say, yeah, things can be really difficult, not just for me, but in the nature of things. We go up and we go down. Everybody does that. There's pleasure and there's pain. As the Buddha described what he called the vicissitudes of life, you know, he talked about eight. There's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. It's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. We go up and we go down. Many years ago, I was hiking with some friends in California. We were in a state park, and we decided we were going to go in for 3 days, and then on the fourth day, turn around and come back out on the same trail we'd gone in on. So this was still the third day, so we were going in. And it turned out to be a day of many hours of very steady, unremitting downhill walking. And we're just kind of walking and walking and walking. At one point, I was with this friend. It was almost like we were struck by the simultaneous realization, and we both just stopped. And we looked at each other, and he said to me, in a dualistic universe, downhill can only mean one thing. And sure enough, the next day when we turned around, it was many, many, many hours of very constant, steady uphill walking. There you go. And it's not that on every level of life it's a dualistic universe, but on the level in which we know pleasure and we know pain, we know praise and we know blame, we do. We go up and we go down, and it's all a part of things. There is no one in life who experiences only pleasure and no pain, or only praise and no blame. You know, you do something from the most, the best intention you can be coming from. You act as skillfully as you can. Some people like it. Some people don't like it. You know, and then we always think, well, if I'd only done it better, everyone in the universe would have thanked me for it, you know. But it's not like that, is it? You know, it's such a complicated world of going up and down and being able to acknowledge the pain that we genuinely feel is a big part of that. And it's also interesting that, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, being able to feel our own pain and acknowledge it and recognize it and be truthful about it is the basis of empathy, and it's the basis of ethics in the best sense of ethical training, which is not merely subscribing to rules and regulations, but it's having this kind of inner feeling, wow, I know what it feels like to be lied to. I know how terrible that feels. I know how overlooked I felt, how almost annihilated I felt. I don't want to do that to somebody else. I don't want to tell a lie and have them feel the pain I felt. You know, so it's not about trying to, certainly not about being sanctimonious or self-righteous or even about trying to fit a certain norm in your mind, you know, an idea of who you should be. It's because you have felt the pain of being lied to, being stolen from, being hurt in some way. And you're able to acknowledge it, to recognize it. You kind of don't want to do that to someone else. And, you know, it's feeling our own pain, it's recognizing the pain we can be in, that does create a sense of empathy. Because if we are cut off from that, then we can objectify anybody. And once we objectify somebody, once they are the other, we can do anything. Because there's not that sense of registering, oh, this is what it would feel like. Just the way it felt that way for me. So there are many layers of compassion and empathy and ethics and realization that come from just being able to see our own difficult situation. How much something hurts. It's not a bad thing. It's really a very tremendous thing. So this dukkha-dukkha, we all have that. And then there are other layers or levels of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness that are talked about. There's the dukkha of change, getting what we want, having this beautiful experience, and then it's over. Or it breaks, you know, we get an object, some material object that we've wanted for so long, and it breaks. Or I got a computer a few months ago, and which I was very much looking forward to, my new computer. I had the computer, and one day, for no reason that I could discern, this screen turned upside down. And I was like, what's that? You know, so I called like everyone in the world I knew. I don't know what to do, you know. Finally, somebody called me back, and of course, what I had to do was very hard, because the mouse was like... and then, you know, it turned around. But I never felt the same way about it after that. It was very different, you know. We get what we want, and something turns around, you know. It's not quite that way. Or even, you know, just this kind of fleeting sense of things. You know, it's the way... day goes so quickly, a season goes so quickly, a lifetime goes so quickly, that everything is always flowing. We actually can't hold on successfully. It's not like it's painful, it's not brutal, it's not like, you know, terribly grievous, but it's just this certain sense of the tentativeness of everything. You know, it's much, much more subtle than the first kind of dukkha. Because it's not that it feels bad, but it's so, like, dreamlike. Everything just goes. I was once sitting in a car with somebody going to Garrison, New York, and which is like an hour or so outside of New York City. And I think he actually was from here. he didn't live in New York City, but he had lived there when he was much younger. And it was interesting kind of going through the city with him, because he'd say, oh, that's the street corner where like 20 years ago I was standing there after I found that I lost my job, and I was like completely freaked out. And that's the place where I had this insane fit of jealousy, you know, and that's the place where I fell in love. And, you know, and it was just so interesting just watching him kind of point out these different spots in the city. And it was just like a dream. You know, 20, 30 years later, it's like, oh yeah, that was the place. Where'd that go? You know, and, you know, that feeling we get, it's so evocative of how fleeting, ephemeral, tentative all experiences in life are. So the Buddha, in trying to describe this, would use certain images. You know, it's as when he said life is like a rainbow, like an echo, like a dream. It's like a flash of lightning in a summer sky, like a drop of dew on a blade of grass. It's there. All of our experiences arise. And it's so fleeting. It's so insubstantial. You know, so it's not meant to be like, this is a terrible ordeal, this is awful suffering. But there's just something, this feeling, it's like incompleteness. an inability to hold on, to keep, to preserve. It's got this very soft, almost like a bittersweet sort of feeling to it. And this is the second kind of dukkha that's talked about. And more subtle yet is the third kind of dukkha, which is the dukkha of conditionality. This idea that nothing stands alone. There are wondrous things about this too, and beautiful things about this realization too. But there's also a very quiet kind of dukkha. It's like, I think of it sometimes as poignancy. You know, that everything is born out of conditions coming together and coming apart. Nothing is independent. Nothing is alone. So if you want to have dinner tonight, we don't have the capacity to say, poof, there's dinner. You know, we have to have bought the food or grown the food. And to buy the food, maybe we need a job. And, you know, to have the job, maybe we need a car. And to have the car, maybe we need, you know, it's like layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of conditions that need to come together for anything to happen. And of course, dinner is not the most stirring example, but what if you had a friend who was really in terrible pain, distress, emotional distress? Wouldn't you like to be able to say, poof, you're better? It's not like that. You know, we don't have that kind of control over the unfolding of events. As all these layers of conditions need to come together for something to arise, for something to be there. And so it's that feeling, you know, if you have a friend who's in trouble, and you know, perhaps even quite accurately, what might turn their lives around, and you can't make it happen. They have to do certain things, other things need to change. We're not in control of the unfolding of events. It's just how it is. It's not, you know, pondering this or contemplating this is not meant to lead to apathy or resignation or cynicism. But it is that kind of poignancy that also can be a doorway to equanimity, to true balance of mind, that has us wholeheartedly and completely try, knowing we're not in control, that we can't have an expectation. We can't, you know, really have that kind of impatience, like, get better, will you? And we can, but it doesn't help that much. You know, so it's almost like there's just a certain tone to this recognition that it's a conditioned reality. Everything needs to come together for something to happen. We can't just deem a direction. We can't demand a change. We can't, you know, enforce our desire. And it's just this kind of poignancy, like, oh yeah, that's how things are. So this is really the some of the layers of the First Noble Truth, that there's dukkha or there's suffering, there's unsatisfactoriness in life. It doesn't mean life is bad. It doesn't mean it's horrible. It doesn't mean we're always in a bad mood and, you know, have bad things happen for us. But if we look carefully, we can see within these dimensions of the three aspects of dukkha, we can just feel it. But yeah, this is true. But then we really examine, you know, if this is in the nature of things, how do we relate to it? And is the relationship to what we are experiencing one that is exacerbating the pain, having us feel more isolated, resenting being out of control? Or is it a quality of relationship that ultimately joins us to one another, that offers peace of mind, that offers clarity, that offers compassion for ourselves and for others? And so this is our tremendous opportunity. Are we denying pain? Are we pushing it away? Are we desperately holding on to pleasure as though we could? I mean, the Buddha used another very simple but cogent example when he said, to hold on tightly to that which must inevitably change is like holding on tightly to a revolving wheel. At some point or another in the cycle, you are bound to get run over. You know? And what do? We hold on even tighter. We say, well, last time didn't work out that well, but this time, you know. You know, can we have a different quality of relationship, which includes everything in our field of awareness, our field of caring, our field of balance? That's our work. It's not to only have pleasure, because that day is not going to come, but to develop a relationship with everything, pleasure, pain, neutrality, that is very connected, very alive, very aware, open, and balanced, so that the wisdom can keep flourishing and compassion can keep flourishing. So to say that there is suffering in life doesn't mean that, you know, we're just meant to be morose about that. But to take a look and also to use that understanding for continued growth as a human being, both for oneself and for a community, you could say, of all of life. It's really what's very important. It's where we start. Can we acknowledge this, the kind of pain, and can we relate to it in a way that is more wholesome, more skillful, so that it yields some very, very beautiful kinds of fruit? And then there's the second noble truth, which is the cause of suffering, the cause of dukkha, in the sense of ignorance and clinging or grasping. Some of the kinds of grasping or clinging are really like what I just said. It's insisting that something be permanent when there is not a chance in the universe it's going to be permanent. Insisting on being in control when we will never be in control. I once, you know, living in Massachusetts, in Barrie, there's, as some of you know, I'm sure you've been on retreat there, some of you, we have the retreat center, and there's a very beautiful 3-mile walk around that many people will do after lunch on a retreat. And I was there one autumn, and it happened to be a particularly glorious, beautiful, amazing autumn, and the leaves on the trees were just fantastic. And I have a friend in California who called me one day, and she said she'd never been to the East Coast at all. So as far as I was concerned, she'd never seen a real autumn. And she called me one day and said, I'm coming. And I'm coming like in a week or 10 days. And that was good news, you know, and I was very excited. And then I noticed that every day when I would walk on that 3-mile loop, I would see those beautiful, amazing leaves on the trees, and I'd think, you better stay up there. You know, like, she's never seen an autumn. You know, it's not going to be right if she comes and they're just like little brown shriveled things on the ground. You know, you better stay up there. And the next day I'd walk and I'd have the same sort of baleful, you know, gaze and insistence in my mind. And then one day she called me and she said, well, you know, something came up and I'm not able to come. And I can remember the first feeling I had was actually one of relief. You know, it was like, oh, good, now I can let the leaves fall from the trees. You know, that worked. You know, we have such a, you could say like a distorted kind of conditioning in a way, that the things we do to be happy are often the very things that make us less happy. You know, we think if we only hold on, that it'll go our way, things won't change, leaves won't fall from the trees, we won't suffer, and we suffer much more. You know, so this idea of the cause of dukkha, or the arising of dukkha, is around the sense of grasping, it's ignorance. You know, where it's not a question of like sort of the poignancy and the more subtle kinds of dukkha, but we suffer badly when we hold on, when we push away, when we live in denial, when we insist on being in control, when we'll never be in control. You know, so it's looking at those things, you know, often really done, as we all know, because we think we're going to be happier. Things will work out better. So it takes quite a bit of examination and investigation to look at those tendencies and say, wow, you know, that was an odd thing to do for the millionth time. Like I didn't notice that, you know, up until now, it's only made things worse. But we don't notice until we really pay careful attention. And you could say a dispassionate way. Dispassion doesn't mean cold. It means being willing to see things as they actually are. And so it's tremendously liberating to realize, oh, I don't have to fall into those same patterns. There's another way of being with this. Enjoying something isn't the same thing as clinging to it. You know, letting go isn't the same thing as kind of spurning or rejecting. It's allowing things to be as they actually are. So it's very different. I had a Tibetan teacher I was very close to. His name was Nyoshal Ken Rinpoche. And in my house in Barrie, I have two large photos on the fireplace mantelpiece of him. They were taken on a day when we were in the Catskills together, and we went to visit a friend's house, and the friend was a veterinarian, and he had all kinds of animals around the house, and he had a dove, and in the first photo, my teacher was known as Kenpo, the dove lands on his hand, so he's just like holding it like this, and it's so beautiful, because it's such a kind of cherishing, caring look on his face, and it's just like holding the dove. And the next photo, the dove is flying away. And he's like, Kenpo's just completely exhilarated. He's like, yeah, you know, let it go. And it's a beautiful duo of pictures, you know, because you can see how lucky he felt to have this dove in his hand, to have contact with it, to be holding it, how tender that was. And then the sheer exhilaration of like, let it go. It's flying away. That's in the nature of things. That's how things are. You know, so none of that is sort of depressing. You know, this idea of relinquishing control doesn't make us less happy. It makes us a whole lot more happy and in touch and fulfilled and able to give. Because when we're holding on, we have a very limited view. First of all, it's deluded because we think we can accomplish something we can't accomplish. But even aside from that delusion, we have in effect narrowed our perspective about, narrowed our view of what we feel we need to be whole, to be complete. We need this and only this. This person, this object, this experience. So either we are fixated on what we don't yet have, which is kind of an unfortunate thing to obsess about all day long, and are out of touch with what we do have, or we're fixated on how to keep someone or something from changing, which isn't going to work. You know, so in either case, it's like this narrowing of view. It's like this old Indian saying where from India where they say when a pickpocket meets a saint, they see only the saint's pockets. You know, we can have such a narrow view of what's out there. And there's a big world out there, but we don't see it because we're, you know, we're insistent, we're fixated. We're obsessed with something we don't have. It's that kind of closing, that holding that is in the nature of grasping. And it's very unfortunate because it doesn't really give us much and we're capable of so much more. This is in contrast to something like loving kindness or compassion or generosity, you know, which really opens us way beyond the narrow confines of our grasping or holding on. There's tremendous joy in letting go, in the right kind of letting go. There's such huge delight in generosity and in compassion and in being loving. It's very different, you know. And so we explore this terrain. It's not that, you know, having set a course of being on a path, one never experiences attachment anymore. But the most important thing seems to be to pay attention. One day I was sitting years ago, and I had the thought, I wonder how the Buddha did this formulation about attachment or ego clinging being the source of suffering. And then I had this funny thought. I thought, maybe he watched it in his own mind. You know, he just watched the arising of clinging. And he watched its nature. And he watched its function and its characteristics and its manifestations and what it did. And I thought, oh, that's how he found that. He saw it. And if it hadn't arisen, you know, he wouldn't have seen it. Therefore, it's okay if it arises. You know, but what are we learning from it? What are we seeing? What is it helping us transform in some way? And so we take a look at the nature of holding on, not in a way that belittles ourselves or punishes ourselves or, you know, has a kind of massive superego, you know, function. I'm a Buddhist, I shouldn't be holding on. And I don't care about anything, you know, everything's all right. Uphill's the same as downhill, doesn't matter. But truthfully, honestly, you know, to be paying attention, to look at what happens when we hold on, to look at what happens when we let go. There are many ways in which one can take a certain quality and see different aspects of it in many elements of a spiritual path. So if you look at something like generosity, for example, which is one of those qualities, there are ways we practice generosity externally, the ways we practice generosity internally. Can we be kind to ourselves? You know, what's that movement of letting go of a distraction? You know, when we're holding on really, really, really tight and then we let go, there's such a feeling of relief. It's a kind of generosity of the spirit when we're holding on really, really, really tight to an identification with something. And then we let go. Like being in an airport, wondering how in the world you're going to get somewhere or another that you're going to. One of my favorite mantras now is, something will happen. You know, either I'll spend the night in the airport, or I'll go to a hotel, or I'll make it to Seattle, or something will happen, you know. And isn't it true? Something will happen. It may not be desirable, but it'll happen. You know, what's it like to let go? And really just pay attention to our lives in that way. So another aspect of clinging or grasping is really the sense of ego clinging. It's the nearly incessant self-preoccupation that we have, which we mistake for actually loving ourselves, when it's really very different. It's, I was teaching with my friend Krishnadas in Madison the other night after the Dalai Lama finished teaching, and Krishnadas used an example he likes to use, which is, you know, we wake up in the morning, and from the moment we wake up, we start starring in, writing, producing, and directing the story of me. And then we write critiques of it all day long, you know, like, oh. You know, and I contrast that to somebody like the Dalai Lama who will say, has said very famously, I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. You think about, you know, how do we usually meet somebody? It's like we hardly even notice them. It's like, what do they think of me? Do they like me? How much do they like me? Do they like me more than they've ever liked anybody before? Oh no, I said something really stupid. They hate me. They're always going to hate me. How can I make up this? I can't make up this. You know, just like, I mean, them? It doesn't matter, you know. But what would it be like to be like a tiny bit more like the Dalai Lama, you know? I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. To pay attention to somebody, not just kind of drawing all the energy into ourselves. To care about them, to listen, to have an open mind, you know, not be so overcome by expectations. It'd be very different and quite delightful. You know, so we think that constantly thinking about ourselves is some kind of basis for genuine self-care, but it's not. It's very different than that. So we cling to objects, to people, to experiences, to the sense of I, me, mine. And we suffer. And so the recognition of this and turning the tide so we're not so caught in these habits is obviously, it's really essential. Otherwise we will go on forever, you know? It's easier to go on forever the way we have been than to challenge the norms, you know, and the habits that may have been going on for a long time. So this is the second noble truth. It's the cause of suffering. Attachment, clinging, ignorance, in the sense of ego clinging. And it's a whole exploration of many layers, many levels. It's fine. You know, it's not going to all happen in one fell swoop. And then there's the third noble truth, which is the end of suffering, which we like. Which also exists on many levels. Even if this poignancy, even if this kind of bittersweet flavor exists, even if, you know, there are grave instances of suffering, it's not that, you know, sometimes people think, well, if I really meditate long and hard, I won't get headaches anymore, I won't die, I won't have unpleasant things happen. My book will be a bestseller. You know, no one is going to blame me for that comment. Downhill will not imply uphill. You know, that somehow it will be a transcendent state removed from any kind of pain or disagreeable instance. But actually, it's like if you look at the life of somebody like the Buddha, you know, certainly as the legends, as the stories exist, you know, the Buddha had backaches, was a famous saying. He did, according to the stories. He had people denouncing him. He had people lying about him. His cousin tried to kill him. He, you know, went into town sometimes and, you know, the custom is to live on alms food, you know, so they go out on alms round every day, the monks and in many cases the nuns. And sometimes he'd go to a town, once he went to a town, he only got like horse feed or something like that. Or, you know, things happen. It's in the nature of things. But how are we with it? You know, there's a story I've always liked, which goes something like a farmer was very upset about the Buddha. I don't know if the monks and nuns were walking over his land. There was some reason he was very upset, or he thought he had a reason to be very upset. And so he went up to the Buddha and he was screaming at him and yelling at him and abusing him and reviling him. And the Buddha said something like, what happens, sir, when you offer somebody a gift and they won't take it? And the farmer said, oh, well, then it remains with me, the giver. And the Buddha said, well, just so. I'm not accepting the gift of your shouting and your abuse and so on. It's going to remain with you. You know, now that's different as a response, right? You know, so even though the circumstance arose, that is quite unpleasant. The nature of the Buddha's understanding, his relationship to that, was very different. It's not like taking it to heart, like, yes, I am the most despicable creature that ever lived. And it's also not like shouting back, you know, it's something not so caught in the circumstance. So it's not that unpleasant things will cease to happen, but we can be very, very different with them. And of course there are different levels of this. One of my teachers, this man named Manindra, in quoting the teaching said, a moment of mindfulness is a moment of freedom. Because mindfulness, one way of defining mindfulness is to be aware of what's happening without adding on clinging, condemning, or pushing away, or what they'll call delusion, which in this context means like when something is just sort of ordinary and neutral, we fall asleep or we get numb. So mindfulness is the ability to be with experience without clinging, without having aversion, and without falling into delusion or this kind of numbing out or disconnection. That's a moment of freedom. So a moment of mindfulness is a moment of freedom. And, you know, again, what's extraordinary about the quality of mindfulness is that we can be mindful no matter what's happening. Because mindfulness is about how we are relating to what's happening. So sometimes we say mindfulness doesn't take the shape of what it's watching. We can be mindful of a beautiful, glorious state. And maybe the challenge is not to cling, not to hold on. We can be mindful of a very difficult, painful state. And the challenge is to have an open heart, not to condemn it, not to condemn ourselves for it. And an awful lot of time is just in that neutral zone. You know, it's not very pleasant, it's not very unpleasant. We can be mindful there too. We can actually wake up and be connected. You know, I've often thought that just in general, you know, in this country, it's like we're not really trained much to subtlety. And so we need that kind of sense of intensity just to feel alive, so we think. But actually, awareness can make us feel alive. Mindfulness can help us feel alive. Even when it's just the kind of, oh, it's one more breath, you know, sort of situation. So mindfulness doesn't take the shape of what it's watching. We can be mindful with anything. Therefore, we can be free no matter what's going on. How entangled are we in it? How clearly are we seeing it? How much aversion or resistance do we have? How much balance do we have? Those become the questions. Not so much what's happening, but how are we with what's happening? So a moment of mindfulness is a moment of freedom. And then, of course, there are states, you could say states of freedom, that are talked about in the context of the Third Noble Truth, the end of suffering. States of real relinquishment of identification, of grasping, where there's a very different perspective or vision on the nature of reality, to see things as they actually are. One way of saying it is that there are states one can experience from which there's no going back. You know, we can have so much confidence in what we've seen to be true that it's a kind of foundation for us, so that we are different. You know, we're actually very affected by that which we've seen, so that we are different. And there are different levels of freedom in this regard. And of course, classically, it's talked about as nirvana or nibbana. And for a state that, you know, for which they say there are no words and it's impossible to describe and it's not really a state anyway, it's not that easy to talk about. But to imagine going right to the heart of one's experience, almost to see the nature of life itself, to not have the extra levels of confusion, of despair, of fear that cloud how we perceive things. To have a very different sensibility of life, I think comes somewhat close to this. You can even see it in a sense around an understanding of interdependence in a way. You know, it's like you can look at a tree and see just a tree, like a seemingly solid, separate entity. Or you can look at a tree and have a sense of the earth, which is nourishing it, and everything that affects the quality of that soil, and the rain, which is falling down upon it, and everything which affects the quality of that rain, and the sunshine and the moon and all of that, that's the tree, actually. It's a network of relationships and connections and influences and interactions. That's the tree. That's every one of us in this moment. It's just a kind of very different sense. So nirvana is defined, of course, differently in lots of different traditions, but has some of this sense of that which is not entangled in the kind of confusions of this world. You know, and it can be seen in a lot of different ways, and yet, however it's seen, it's not considered something that's, you know, sort of endlessly remote. The path to, you could say, more ultimate kind of freedom, which is contained in that understanding, is the immediate freedom of moment after moment of mindfulness. You know, it's seeing how we relate to this moment's experience, and this moment's wonderful experience, and this moment's painful experience, and this moment's neutral experience, and the next moment's painful. You know, and it's just like there is actually a path, which, you know, I'll go into much more tomorrow, but in terms of mindfulness being at the core of it, this is what's important. You know, it's not sort of imagining the happy day when we'll be completely enlightened and not bothering to do anything about it. And it's not sitting in despair and saying, well, I could never actually be free and not bothering to do anything about it. But it's using each moment's experience as completely as we can as part of that unfolding. It's like this teacher of mine, Manindra, once said to me in a way that was very important for me, the Buddha's enlightenment solved the Buddha's problem. Now you solve yours. And it was actually a great moment, you know, because it felt like maybe the first time in my life somebody was looking at me as though to say, you know, you can do that. You can solve the problem of your confusion and your unhappiness and all of that which brought you to India to begin with. You can do that. Here are the tools. You know, now it's up to you to use them. So that takes us through Noble Truths 1, 2, and 3. And tomorrow we'll emphasize loving kindness, and I'll talk about the path, which is the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path. So why don't we do some walking meditation now?